continuing challenges to women's rights and health.
It's something that's happening in state after state, and it's an attempt to control and dominate women.
Efforts to circumvent Roe v. Wade, attempts to stop sex trafficking in California, plus a call to action for young women. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. State by state, the Supreme Court's 40-year-old ruling on abortion is being challenged. North Dakota's comes on the heels of a similar ban on abortion in Arkansas, passed March 6th after the legislature overrode a gubernatorial veto. The Arkansas law prohibits abortion after 12 weeks of pregnancy. Similar bills are soon to be taken up in Ohio and Kansas. Danielle Norwood, organizer with Women Organized to Resist and Defend, spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar about the politicizing of women's rights.
The approval of House Bill 1456 by North Dakota legislators on Friday, March 15th, is the latest in a fight being waged by extremists across the country. This so-called fetal heartbeat bill, if signed into law, will ban abortion for women in the state as early as 6 weeks. North Dakota's attack on women comes on the heels of a similar ban in Arkansas, passed March 6th after the legislature overrode a gubernatorial veto. The Arkansas law prohibits abortion after 12 weeks of pregnancy. Both measures trample multiple Supreme Court decisions upholding Roe v. Wade and the right to abortion until a fetus is considered viable. Similar bills are soon to be taken up in Ohio and Kansas. Danielle, what are some of the more challenging aspects of what we're seeing now regarding abortion ban bills like the one in Arkansas?
This has been happening across the country, escalating in the last couple of years. What's particularly awful about the Arkansas bill is that it would ban abortion after 12 weeks, which, according to all research, there's no reason for that. You know, it's pushing further back the abortion rights that we've already won. So in that respect, it is stronger attack than the others that we've seen. But, you know, we've seen bills like this across the country. In Virginia, they're trying to require transvaginal ultrasounds, which are just incredibly invasive, unnecessary, and it's something that's happening, again, in state after state. And it's an attempt to control and dominate women and to take away our reproductive freedom, to take away our control over our own bodies and the decision whether or not to have a family and when we do that. In a political situation where women's human rights are being treated as bargaining chips, as political currency, these are our most basic human rights. The right to control your own body, the right to decide when you have children or if you have children is huge. You know, when a woman loses agency, when we lose the power to say what we do with our bodies and when and whether we have kids, then we lose a lot of freedom. So it's the most basic, fundamental right that we as women have, and it's something that we have to fight very hard to protect because it is. It's a basic human right that's being attacked.
Why have strategies like the Arkansas law gotten so much traction, in your opinion?
You know, these are attacks, as we were discussing, on basic human rights. The ability to decide whether and when you have kids is a basic human right. So I think that these politicians, while certainly not incredibly intelligent or savvy, are smart enough to know that they need to find another way to frame these attacks. And the way that they're doing that is by elevating the fetus, by talking about these hypothetical, innocent, unborn children, instead of talking about the women, the, you know, living, breathing, walking, talking women whose rights they're disregarding completely. You know, it's easy to build up this sort of idea of a perfect unborn child and then demonize a woman as compared to it. But, you know, we're here. These are our rights. And you can't make up an imaginary sort of either-or situation to take away women's human rights. This Arkansas bill, it's one of the most severe attacks on women's rights that we've seen in the last couple of years. And these are a couple of years that have seen a lot of attacks on women's rights. So it's a particularly heinous attack. It's a really disgusting piece of legislation. And what it would do is basically outlaw abortion after 12 weeks, completely in the face of our established rights, of prior Supreme Court decisions. It's very much a political maneuver that I would suspect the legislators who proposed it know is not constitutional, know is not workable, and therefore they're pushing it forward just as an attack on women's rights. Attacks like this are the reason that it's so important to have an organized fighting women's movement. When we build a strong women's movement, then we have the ability to respond all over the country. you know, the next time we march to have twice as many women in the street, and men as well, and, you know, all allies, everyone who fights for justice and equality should be fighting for women's rights right now, because I think that these attacks are escalating. It's a serious issue right now. So it's super important to get involved, to stay involved, and to be part of the women's movement.
Danielle Norwood is an organizer with Women Organize to Resist and Defend. Find out more at defendwomensrights.org. That interview comes to us courtesy Liberation Radio. Concern about whether young women understand what's at stake led Kim Wyatt to co-edit a collection of essays called Get Out of My Crotch, 21 Writers Respond to America's War on Women's Rights and Reproductive Health. This isn't a dry academic book about the abortion issue. This is a collection of very personal essays about people who say this is the experience and this is why I support a woman's right to choose. What made you decide to use this route to get into this discussion?
Well, it started last year. The legislation that was coming up was just so egregious to me. And it wasn't strictly about choice, but it was about, you know, transvaginal ultrasounds and personhood and all those things together. Just I felt like I had to do something, so I put a call out to these writers. And they responded in great numbers and were supportive of the book and decided to contribute.
And what was your reaction as you started to get these essays and to read them? Because there's not a single one that doesn't really hit you hard.
My reaction was that you know, at first it was about choice, and my co-contributor, Sari Botten, she was the one who suggested we publish it on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which was a great idea. So what happened is we started receiving the essays is we noticed that it was really about the culture that supports this kind of legislation and the culture that supports kind of an anti-choice way of thinking. That's what the book ended up reflecting.
And tell me about a couple of the essays that really struck you.
One that really struck me was by Dolores P. She's a healthcare provider, and it's called Ask an Abortion Provider, and it's coming from the point of view of someone who actually provides these services. In addition, we had several essays from the point of view of women who had actually had abortions and, you know, how heartbreaking it can be, and just kind of expanded the discussion.
And interestingly enough, last year in the political season, it did seem that abortion was a huge issue. And suddenly the attention has flipped, and now we're suddenly looking at gay marriage. Do you expect that to flip back again? I would assume this isn't over.
There's an essay in this book called Justice for All by S.E. Smith, and she talks about how reproductive rights is really right now limited largely to a discussion about, you know, pretty much white middle-class women and abortion, and it really needs to be talking about reproductive rights for everyone, every person. So I think that's what we're going to see next. And also in a few of these essays, one of the writers is a Mother Jones reporter, Kate Shepard, and she wrote a piece about rape. Last year we had the definition of rape, you know, considered by several politicians. And Kate Shepard wrote about the Americans United for Life. And one of the things that came out of some of these essays is that the groups that are looking at limiting choice or removing choice, they're bypassing federal legislation and they're just going state by state, and it's very effective. So that's kind of been a shift in thinking.
And overall, the tone in the book reminded me of old-fashioned feminism, that stand up and make some noise kind of, if you don't speak out and speak up, people will do things that perhaps you don't agree with. And I'm wondering if that's something that young women are catching on to.
Okay, this is actually why I made the book. I have several young women working in my office. And every day at work, I would read these stories. And one day I yelled, "Get out of my crotch." And one of the young women said that would make a great title, book title. And at the time, we were talking a lot about politics. It was, you know, the run-up to the presidential election, and the young women in my office were feeling really disenfranchised, cut off, very cynical about politics. And I wanted them to know that there was really a lot at stake, and I felt they needed to be paying attention to legislation. So I made the book for them, and something really, really cool happened at our last reading. We've been having readings across the country, and we had one in Sacramento last week. At the end of the reading, we had a Q&A, and a young woman stood up and said, "What can we do? What can we do?" They decided right there on the spot in this reading to start a speaker series on reproductive health issues. And to me, there's nothing better that can come out of this book. They just ran with it.
Kim Wyatt is co-editor of Get Out of My Crotch, 21 Writers Respond to America's War on Women's Rights and Reproductive Health. Coming up, inspiration for action on behalf of the world's women and children. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1239. Now let's flip the script and focus on responses. There are challenges for the world's women, to be sure, but there are also things you can do. Each one of us can. Dr. Afaf Malaise of the University of Pennsylvania spoke at the Chautauqua Institution, offering a global view of women's issues and a call to action.
As I listen to women all over the world, I listen to what they said. I've been to 60 countries, listened to women in 60 countries. I did my research in about 10, extensive research in about 10 of those. But my listening actually started with my own grandmother, who was not, had no education. She was illiterate in terms of education, but she was wise in terms of life. I listened to her tell me about the babies that she gave birth of in a farm, because she was a farmer, and half of whom died in the process. She gave birth and she took care of it, and she cut the cord herself, and half of them died. She helped me ask the questions why she didn't get help with her birthing and why so many babies died. It's still the same questions we continue to ask. But from her, I also learned about risks for women. I've learned about the power of women and power with education and without education. I was inspired of how she was able, made it possible for her own daughter, my mother, not only to get education but also to progress and get a bachelor and a master and a PhD, and would be the first one to get all these degrees in nursing in the Middle East. And then I was inspired by this mother who shared with me stories about female patients, women who suffered female circumcision or whose husband wanted medical proof that they were virgins. It was her knowledge, it was my mother's knowledge, perspective, compassion and passion and diligent work as a midwife, as a nurse midwife, that ignited my passion for women's health. Pregnancy should be a wonderful time for every woman to feel a new life developing inside of them. However, for many disadvantaged and marginalized women, it comes with grave risks. In fact, in some countries, it is said, the proverbs is said, is that to be pregnant is to put one foot in the grave. The fact is that a woman dies every 90 seconds from a pregnancy complication. What's even more staggering is that 90% of these deaths are preventable. But do you also know that the number one killer for girls between the age of 15 and 19, the number one killer for girls between the age of 15 and 19 is not drugs, and it's not violence, and it's not war. It is pregnancy. It's estimated that 70,000 young women die every year because their bodies are not yet physically ready to handle pregnancy. Why? No access to antenatal care, skilled birth attendants, skilled maternity services. There is a global shortage of nurses and midwives. Why the shortage? Because of lack of investment in nursing and midwifery education. Because of lack of valuation of the work that those caregivers provide. Because these are women's professions, and because they are vital for women. And we are not immune in this country from that. In the United States, 1 in 5 women of reproductive age lack health insurance and can't afford prenatal care. As a result, maternal mortality in our own nation here is surprisingly very high. We rank, here is a fact, we rank 50 among the nations with the lowest rates of maternal mortality rate. It's unforgivable. African American women in the United States are 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than Caucasian women. Universal access to contraception alone would prevent 1/3 of maternal deaths. Mothers suffer the loss of their daughters before they are even born. They abort them because society does not like having the daughters, the baby daughters. So once now they know with the technology that this baby is going to be a daughter, they are encouraged and pushed to abort them. Since 1970, we lost 163 million girls. But imagine being a mother and waking up every morning wondering how you're going to feed your children. Worldwide, malnutrition is the cause of 1/3 of all maternal and childhood death. Women and girls suffer disproportionately from poverty. Approximately 829 million people living below the poverty line are women. In countries like Afghanistan, which is ranked as the number one harshest place to be a mother, 2 out of every 5 children are malnourished, and 1 in 5 will die before the 5th birthday. Compare that with Norway, where 1 in 300 children die before the age of 5. And many of our impoverished cities in the United States, there are an estimated 250,000 child soldiers in the world today. Girls are often used as wives and sex slaves for the male. Human trafficking, a practice that's equivalent to modern-day slavery, is a human rights abuse that's universal. At least 100,000 and perhaps as many as 300,000 children in the United States are victims of sex trafficking each and every year. We have a golden moment right now. There are some really good things going on, and I want to leave you with 5 actions, and I call them the A, B, C, D, E. So A for act, for advocate, and ask questions about women and safety and health in your own community. Be involved in your neighborhood. Those vulnerable women are somewhere in your community. If you look hard, you're going to find them. A, again, for accountable maternity leave benefits, for elder care, for child care, for public safe places for women. B, be a voice. Be a strong voice for many women who do not have the voice to bring out their issues. C, collaborate. If you are engineers or if you are architects, think about what are we engineering that's from a woman's perspective and what their needs are. D, dispel myth, debunk myth. To achieve gender equity, we need to empower women and empower organizations to do that. E is for engage. And I'm going to add a 6th one here, forward, F for forward. We need to continue to move this momentum. Each one of us has a responsibility to move that. What we really need to be doing is to be enraged about the injustice that women are suffering from. You have to be morally enraged about that to have a voice for it. It's individual commitment, but it's also a collective commitment. You need to be enraged and nurture a passion for making a difference in the world.
Dr. Afaf Malaise is the Dean of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania and directs the university's WHO Collaborating Center for Nursing and Midwifery Leadership. She's also Counsel General Emerita of the International Council on Women's Health Issues. This was an excerpt of a speech she gave at the Chautauqua Institution. Find out more at ciweb.org. Parents and advocates in one East Oakland, California neighborhood have stepped up their activism in response to pimps targeting their middle school-aged daughters. This report from Turnstile News is a follow-up to a collaboration between All Things Considered and Youth Radio, looking at the issue of sex trafficking in the U.S.
Over the last year, parents and advocates in the San Antonio neighborhood became active when they realized pimps were targeting their middle school girls.
We are here at Roosevelt Middle School.
That's Nuan Lee. She is the program coordinator for Bonte Saray, a group that works with neighborhood girls to build self-esteem and to teach them how to avoid being recruited by pimps. School district officials say it's hard to prevent because the pimps just look like regular guys.
It happens at the bus stops, it happens in front of homes, and it happens in front of schools.
Lee says the average age that girls get recruited into trafficking in the U.S. is 12 years old. People often think girls end up being trafficked because they were kidnapped, but many times it can start with a seduction or even a relationship. So Lee encourages families to have frank conversations early about dating and sex.
Yeah, it's awkward talking to your parents about sex, right? A common response for parents is to try to shut their children away from seeing this. But the reality is it's so visible and it's so prevalent that we can't do that.
It's so prevalent. The families can look outside their windows and see pimps.
See the corner over here? See that corner over there? Pimps are coming down here. What happens to that?
Reynaldo and Jody Terrazas raised two girls in this neighborhood. They live a block from the National Lodge Motel that the community has been fighting for years, saying pimps run their business from it. From their living room, the Terrazas also have a view of International Boulevard, where girls, some barely teenagers, stand on the corners.
Little girls, you bet. Very skinny. They're probably weigh 100 pounds, maybe 115 pounds. Some of them look very confident and bold about what they're doing. And then there's other times they look like they're trying to get away, to hide, that they don't want to be here.
Oops. Hello.
When you walk up to the National Lodge Motel, you have to be buzzed in. I'm greeted by a small woman sitting behind a thick glass window, like a bank teller. She wouldn't answer any of my questions. So I called the office later and talked to Rita Patel, who is part of the family that owns the motel. Her response to neighbors' fears about sexual exploitation of minors?
No, we don't accept prostitutes here.
You don't at all?
No, we don't.
Since we started pushing, the city attorney filed a lawsuit against this motel.
That's Andy Nelson, deputy director for organizing and public policy at East Bay Youth Center. He's pleased that the city of Oakland has officially joined the fight and is suing to shut down the National Lodge Motel for allowing prostitution and sexual exploitation of minors.
Since we started pushing, there were a couple more officers who were assigned here, and there's been a lot more willingness to talk to us and to try to, you know, work collaboratively. The concern is, you know, what would happen if we stopped pushing?
That pushing includes marches, rallies, and meetings with the mayor, the city council, and the police. Andy Nelson's motivation to keep pushing? His 4-year-old daughter.
As she gets older, it's going to be challenging, you know. But every time I see a young girl out there, you know, I see my daughter.
Until recently, Nelson says a lot of neighborhood parents felt there was nothing that could be done to stop sex trafficking. He says getting rid of the National Lodge Motel is not going to solve the problem, but it would be a big accomplishment. Nelson and others won't give up the idea that Oakland's San Antonio neighborhood can be a good place to raise kids. For Turnstile, I'm Denise Tejada.
That report comes to us courtesy of TurnstileNews.com. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.